Counsel?
Madam Chair, lady members of the committee, if I could just bring you up to date on this bill. This is a bill that passed this subcommittee back in February by a vote of 6-1. Went to full committee, and there was several of the government agencies expressed concern about the bill, so it was sent back to subcommittee to take further testimony.
Daryl Gerritsen. Actually, Mr. Gerritsen, let me do so. I'm going to apologize and ask you to take a seat for a minute. Your name is first, but let me ask if Mr. White and Mr. Kennedy could come up now. Mr. Kennedy is going to have to leave in a minute, and we can get an overview from these people. We all wait around for 20 minutes, and then we have a false start.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Dan Kennedy of the Executive Department, here to talk about House Bill 2421, actually to tell you that Dave White of the Risk Management Division of the Department of General Services will be speaking for us, so I'd like to turn it over to Mr. White.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I am Dave White of the Administrator of the Risk Management Division of the Department of General Services. I have just handed out or provided to be handed out to you some additional detail on the fiscal impact that we did last time the bill was before you. This is a list of the claims which we reviewed. We have since then gone back through our files and looked again at claims, so there may be some new additions to this. These are claims essentially which we have a physical damage claim against us by a business. We therefore went to the file and looked to see if anyone had been injured in that incident, and if there was an injury, to place an estimate of the exposure that the state faces on it. We only have one claim in this list, I believe, which is purely bodily injury. I think all the rest of them included a property damage loss. The reason we only have one that's purely bodily injury is because we just can't find them. Bodily injury claims are brought under individuals' names rather than businesses, so we really don't have any way of knowing without reading every file whether or not the person was employed at the time of loss. We don't keep that kind of record. So there may be some other exposures out there we just don't know about. This is an effort to ascertain, had this law been in place, what claims would have been made against us based on the files that we have. There may be other claims out there that simply would not have come into us. We just don't know about it. The result is an estimate of between $750,000 to $1 million a year. To that, we would add dollar-for-dollar legal cost, which is the actuarial estimate or calculation of what we actually expend in legal expense, leaving us with a $3 to $4 million per biennium.
Are there questions? Representative Edmondson.
Did you have an opportunity to review the file of claim workers, work-related injuries of state employees that also involved public employees where the state might be able to recover from the public third party some of its cost of workers' compensation payments?
Madam Chairman, Representative Edmondson, no. The only claims of that nature would be local public bodies, cities and counties, that we might sue if their employee injured our employee, and we really don't have any way to access that kind of information. We do not, in risk management, prosecute claims against anyone. We rather investigate and defend them, and so we just don't have any record of that kind of thing.
All of these claims here, if I may just follow up, all of these claims are through SAFE.
Representative Edmondson, all these claims are liability claims against the state now. Some are open and some have already been paid and closed. Where a business has claimed that we were responsible for property damage to them, and then upon investigation we find that there was also someone injured or killed in that situation. A wide range of issues here, Madam Chairman, from The fatality, which is listed there, was where a rock fell onto the highway and a truck ran off the road. Another one at the other extreme was a lady employee of a rest home that tripped over a chair moved by a state employee and then lost her leg because she suffered from a debilitating disease which contributed to it. That kind of thing we place a lesser value on because we believe we could defend against it, but we can't know for sure whether we would clearly win or clearly lose.
Is when all of these cases,
Edmondson,
all these cases then, say for a private insurer or a self-insured employer, paid for the loss out of the workers' compensation policy, but could not recover against the state, notwithstanding any negligence that might have occurred by the state.
That would be correct, Madam Chairman. And in fact, it would be any one of the three, Safe, Liberty Northwest, or self-insureds out there, or companies from other states.
Other questions? Representative Mannix.
I'm just curious about the amount of expected legal services costs that you have put down here. Does the state actually pay out a dollar in legal costs for each dollar of loss historically?
Madam Chairman, Representative Mannix, the actuaries tell us that we do. Now, what I have to say is that, of course, whenever you're looking at the numbers as they develop, at different times they may appear otherwise. Right now, this year, for example, or excuse me, the last 3 years, it looks like about 25%. But those years are not fully developed. It'll take several years before they settle out. And the actuarial calculations are that we pay dollar for dollar.
Have you ever compared that to... I'm really getting far afield, and I'll just make a comment, and it just seems to me an extraordinarily high level of legal costs for claims paid, extraordinarily high compared to what I've seen in the private side. Most of these are motor... Excuse me, Madam Chair, may I continue?
Yes.
Thank you. Most of these are motor vehicle accidents?
Not most motor vehicle. Let's see.
Largest proportion of these are motor vehicle accidents.
I should have those numbers here. It really moves around a bit. For example, we face some fairly stiff legal costs in different areas. Oh, most of the claims that I've shown
costs.
You there.
I meant the claims.
Pardon me. Yes, most of the claims that I've provided there involve a motor vehicle, not all of them.
If you're really concerned about that element of exposure, it seems to me that if people are always going to be complaining about the highway division failing to sign an area properly to warn, maybe we should address those specific questions as to whether or not, as a matter of public policy, we want the state to be susceptible to that kind of lawsuit, as opposed to deciding that all people who happen to have workers' comp coverage can't sue the state. Just a thought.
Madam Chair, if I may, that, I think, is an interesting direction there, because essentially the exposure we see we cannot avoid as governments is the ownership of the highways. Other exposures can be managed to different degrees. But what we find out there in the world now between businesses is if a business happens to run into another business in any way and injure those people, that's a somewhat a happenstance thing. But every business is on our highways. And so it's a factor. Now, I should also say the reason that these are motor vehicle or highway-related issues here is because when we had to go look, those were the more likely places to find them. So, as I say, we didn't search for bodily injury because we couldn't identify them.
One other question, please.
Go ahead, Representative Mannix.
Have you factored in the prospect that every time someone has a motor vehicle accident and they don't have another driver that they might be able to blame, they're going to sue the state, saying that you didn't maintain a proper highway or you didn't put up a sign? They're going to try to find some way of getting the state to pay them something.
Chair, we believe that happens now. There are enough claims that come in at this point which we're able to deny rather handily. It looks like it's just kind of a cover all the bases type issue, naming us particularly. We see a variety of cases where signing is blamed or lighting or design when the driver was in large part responsible for other reasons. So.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking us out of order, Madam Chair.
Well, we got you away in time, Mr. Kennedy. Now, Daryl Gerritsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darrell Gerritsen. I'm Assistant Legal Counsel with Marion County, and I'm here on behalf of both Marion County and the Association of Oregon Counties. In regard to 2421, I think you have to ask yourself three questions about this bill. Where is the need? Where is the public interest? And where is the public benefit? Now, in Marion County's case, the figures as far as claims are fairly easy to come up with. Over the last 2 years, we've had three claims each year, which we've rather handily denied. Our claims broke down both times, two slip and falls, one automobile accident. I would project that as far as the impact on Marion County, we would have to reserve between $150,000 to $200,000. The first year that this bill impacted, that'd be reserve set aside to cover the claims. Assuming we successfully defended the claims, you would have a progressively decreasing cost. Yeah. The other side of this bill is that the person who is suing you has been compensated through the workers' compensation system. At least I would hope they've been compensated, and if they haven't, then maybe we have a problem with the benefits we pay out in the workers' compensation system. So that gives rise to the three questions. Where is the need? Is the injured person compensated? They've already been compensated. Where's the public interest? Marion County is self-insured. Clackamas County is self-insured. Washington County is self-insured. Multnomah County is self-insured. Lane County is self-insured. Polk County is self-insured. City of Eugene self-insured. City of Salem self-insured. City of Portland self-insured. We're nonprofit entities. If we have to set aside money to spend it to defend ourselves, it directly comes out of public services. So again, that gets to the question of where is the public benefit?
May I inquire?
Representative Mannix.
Let's assume for the moment that I have a personal insurance policy that allows me to collect $100,000 in medical benefits and $100,000 in general damages. I'm just making this up. Anytime I may be injured and I walk out in the street and a Marion County truck runs me down, should we put an exemption in the law that says anyone who has personal insurance coverage cannot sue? Wouldn't that follow from the same idea of saying, well, they've got workers' comp insurance coverage, so they shouldn't be able to sue?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, if you want to get into the issue of
this
sovereign
is
immunity, I am prepared to defend sovereign immunity.
No. Wait a minute. The philosophical questions you just asked.
Can we just have one question at a time, and then if you would answer the question,
Madam Chair gets
to ask the question and you answer. Unfortunately, that's just the way the tables work here.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, that philosophy would be consistent with that point of view. That is that where you're dealing with public resources, which are scarce, then if a victim or an injured person, I don't want to use the term victim, if an injured person has in fact received some form of compensation, then I would say yes, because otherwise the money is coming out of the public treasury and somebody else is going to be deprived of service.
Now may I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
I'd be happy to have you address the part that you wanted to address, the sovereign immunity issue. Now, you're saying as a matter of philosophy that we should be very careful about where we drop the veil of sovereign immunity, I assume.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, that's correct. The point I would like to make is that we take care of a very high-risk population. We take care of the victims of other people's torts. We take care of them through our mental health system. We take care of them through our health system. The state of Oregon takes care of them through the welfare system. We take care of them, unfortunately, through our jails often, one way or another. We try and prosecute the crimes. We try and collect the money that compensates victims of crimes. There's a whole variety of things we do that tries to look after people who cannot recover means from private parties. Because of what has happened in the insurance industry and in the litigation industry, government entities are now self-insured, and it's a dollar-for-dollar trade-off. It is a reduction in services if we have increased risk exposure and risk payouts. And for that reason, I say you should look very carefully at sovereign immunity.
May I ask one more question?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
Should we take a step back then and reevaluate this whole state tort liability and governmental immunity issue? I say state, I mean all the local governments too. What we were getting at, or what this bill gets at, is a particular exemption which doesn't seem, at least it didn't seem to us in going over the bill, to fit in terms of consistency with the system as it exists today, because we singled out a particular form of what is now often private insurance coverage to say, well, we're not going to be liable to you folks because you happen to have, you happen to be in the course and scope of employment and you've got workers' comp coverage. And should we be reexamining this whole thing, or should we continue to focus on one group and say, well, you're going to carry the burden because we can't afford it?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, I believe you're going to have several bills come before you, which will give you an opportunity. I think you should be reexamining the whole issue of sovereign immunity. The question specifically, reexamining areas of discretionary immunity. We are now at the point where we routinely defend claims for failure to arrest. Failure to arrest is an extremely difficult area. That police officer is out in the street attempting to make decisions on the spur of the moment, taking into account what resources are available. But if he doesn't arrest the person and the person commits another crime, we routinely get a notice on that.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make one other comment on the third-party recoveries very quickly. I would submit that that would merely be a wash except for the money which would be siphoned off for the attorneys, because you would then have the state of Oregon and local governments suing each other routinely. The classic example, a Salem police officer who was shot by a state policeman on a recent drug raid. So I would submit that it would work both ways, state injuring local government employees injuring state employees, and we would have somewhat of a feeding frenzy that would not benefit anyone. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Virgil Wellborn. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Virgil Wellborn, and I represent TriMet.
It's nice to see you on this rerun of House Bill 2421.
Well, Madam Chairman, TriMet once again finds itself in the interesting position of testifying against a bill which some claim to be in the public interest. It is in this instance, I do not feel the proposed change is in the public interest. In fact, I believe it is just the opposite. Any worker who is injured while covered by workers' compensation receives full coverage for medical benefits plus indemnity benefits for wage loss. Currently, these individuals are restricted from bringing suit against a public body. This prevents taxpayers from paying the cost of an accident twice, once as an increased cost of goods and services through workers' compensation premiums, and again as a direct cost of increased taxes to finance additional liability claims paid by the public agency. Another problem is difficulty in projecting fiscal impact. Our best estimate is an additional $500,000 per year, a figure which I feel is conservative. I must stress, however, that this figure is only an estimate. We know that in a majority of cases involving TriMet, a liability claim is not filed due to the immunity provision for public bodies. The impact conceivably could be much greater than our estimate. Aside from the philosophical arguments involved, we have another concern. To fulfill our statutory mandate, which is the delivery of efficient and cost-effective transportation in the Tri-County metropolitan area, at a time when we are under public pressure to expand light rail to the west side in order to relieve some of the traffic congestion in the Sunset Corridor, our resources are shrinking. The state has reduced their assistance in capital funding by $7 million over the biennium, in addition to the continuing reduction in federal assistance. If TriMet's claims costs increase, it is not difficult to conclude that TriMet's resources for providing mass transportation services to the Portland metropolitan area will diminish at a time when we are having difficulty maintaining our current level of services. It will be a hardship to provide the additional services the community expects as well. On behalf of TriMet, I ask that you not place an additional financial burden on an agency that currently cannot fully meet the service expectations placed on it by the community it serves.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Wellborn?
Ask.
Representative Mannix.
Mr. Wellborn, I realize you have to deal with the financial side, and obviously this kind of legislation costs you direct money. Have you asked anyone to check through your claims and see if any of TriMet's employees have been involved in accidents with other government agencies where they might have sued, but for the fact that they were in the course and scope of their employment?
I can think of two offhand, sir.
You're aware then that, of course, there'd be third-party liability where TriMet, either the employee or TriMet, could bring action to recover against those other entities.
It's been my experience, sir, that in those cases where suit is filed, this involves non-governmental entities involving our employees, we very rarely recover more than 50% of our costs.
Now, in terms of the, if there was no budgetary impact, we stepped away from that, and I realize you can't live in that environment because you have to deal with budgetary impact, but for a moment, if you stepped away from pure dollars and cents and looked at the equity provision, that is the idea that one person who happens to have workers' compensation can't sue, whereas the person who, excuse me, did I say that right? The person who doesn't have workers' compensation can sue. The person who does not is prohibited from, I can't talk this afternoon. You know what I mean. One has coverage, one doesn't. The person who's got coverage cannot proceed. The person who doesn't have coverage can go ahead. That's a pretty artificial distinction now, isn't it? Witness the earlier example I came up with, someone has their own coverage that they've bought out somewhere.
Well, I could only say a couple of things about that, sir. I guess one thing, you have to make a decision on whether you feel workers' comp is an adequate insurance system or not, and I don't think that that's being debated here. The other is that workers' compensation is paid by all the taxpayers in this state. I don't care whether it's paid by additional costs or not. In your example, as I understand it, you were talking about a private insurance policy that you would have paid for yourself.
Well, we no longer have SAFE as the exclusive workers' comp insurer for Oregon, and actually SAFE writes less than a majority of the coverage now. So actually most of the workers' compensation in Oregon is privately funded, not taxpayer funded, except to the extent that we're all taxpayers.
Well, no, sir, because if you are a member of SAFE, you pay SAFE a premium, and that premium is generated by the goods and services that you're purchasing.
Representative Mayor,
thank you. One last question.
Another question.
Let's talk about Liberty Northwest so we don't get confused here. I'm guessing 40% of the coverage is now provided by Liberty Northwest, a private corporation. They collect premiums from employers. People pay for that coverage. It's not taxpayer money other than the fact that all citizens who happen to make money pay taxes. Liberty Northwest insures employee X, who has a motor vehicle accident with one of your people are at fault. Because that person has workers' comp coverage, he can't recover from your people. Liberty Northwest can't go in there and present their lien and recover. They're left in the ditch, so to speak. But another person who has no workers' comp coverage whatsoever can recover from your people. And what I'm trying to get is the equity distinction there. Let's forget about talking about SAFE. I grant you that they're a quasi-public corporation.
I don't think it makes any difference, sir, where the premium goes, whether it goes to SAFE, which is an insurance company, whether it goes to Liberty Northwest, or in our case, where we're self-insured. It costs everybody that rides TriMet or everybody that buys a loaf of bread in this state so much money for workers' compensation. Then if you come again in the area of the public sector and say, gee whiz, you should pay again, I personally find that inequitable.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman.
Charlie Williamson.
Madam Chair, Charles Williamson, Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We've already testified on this measure. I have a hard time trying to answer all these fiscal allegations, but except to say they seem outrageously exaggerated. On the first page of the document you got today from the risk management section, we have two fatalities where the $200,000 apiece is to be paid. I think the maximum under the Tort Claims Act, unless there's more than $100,000 in special damages or medical costs, would be limited to $100,000. Why they would spend $200,000, $100,000 in attorney fees and $100,000 on the claim would not seem to make any sense. As I understand it, Madam Chair, from the state's testimony last time, they pay about $3.5 million annually in all claims that would be affected by this type, all claims of a type that would be affected by this measure. They indicated an increase of $1.6 million as a result of this measure annually. If I just ask you to consider that only about 45% of the people in the state are employed. You're only talking about less than half the people who would be covered by workers' compensation. And they're only employed about 22% of the time. They've got vacations, they got weekends, they got 16 hours a day. So you're really only talking about maybe at most a 10% increase in whatever the state is paying out now. Or $350,000 a year. So I think it really is infinitesimal compared to what they're saying. But regardless of how much it is, SAFE now takes in $3.7 million a year in third-party claims. And they're only 40% of the third-party cases, since that's roughly the number of employees they have. However much governments have to pay, SAFE is going to inure to more of a profit than the state loses. That's the only other points I'd like to make, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Are there questions?
I have a question.
Representative Minnis.
Mr. Williamson, if that's true, why hasn't SAFE testified to that effect?
Well, I think SAFE, I really don't know. I've asked SAFE for the figures. I've pointed out to them the benefits of the bill to them, and I can't understand why they're not here.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Clark.
Mr. Williamson, can you help me remember, maybe we covered this before, maybe you covered it today, but why this provision was originally in? I can think of no public policy reason for the provision to remain in.
I went back and looked at the...
I'm hearing fiscal reasons, and I want to be sensitive to that, but I can think of no public policy reason for the exclusion to stay in. Do you know why it was originally put in?
I went back and looked at the legislative history, and the only thing when they were discussing it, it appeared to me, and I can't say there's anything that's clear on the record, but it appeared to me they assumed that it was the state's own employees that were being precluded from suing the state. And that when the initial bill passed, I think that most of the people that voted for it just figured that was the exemption. And we're not trying to change that here, but I don't know what was in their minds, but I think in the discussion that's what people were thinking.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Williamson. We're going to move out of public hearing we'll move into a public hearing on House Bill 2529 relating to maintenance of easements. We'll be getting back on 2421. I want to advise the committee on House Bill 2421 that we've already held a work session on 2421. We passed out to full. I'm a little bit at a loss as to what the procedure is, since votes need to be reconsidered on the day that they are passed. We'll do something with it. I'm open to your suggestions on just what, but we will go into work session right now on 2529. And Mr. Aukert, I believe, is here. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Roy Okert. I'm from Talent, Oregon. Until my retirement in July 1985, I was the chief economist for the International Woodworkers, and I worked as an economist mainly for unions for quite a number of years before. I also was an ordained Unitarian minister. I hope you will bear with me a bit this afternoon. I buried my wife this morning. Virginia and I were married 39 years ago, come June 11th. I've come, despite the trauma of the last weeks and months, because this bill was terribly important to her. We had, in early 1970s and mid-1970s, we had looked for a place to retire, and we finally found a place in southern Oregon and spent virtually all of our time from then on our vacation.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. I see no provision in the bill for the plaintiff to certify to the court how he or she has accomplished service. Can I assume that normal, believe it or not, I have never been in small claims court at all.
Can't be as an attorney.
Well, I understand that. Can I assume that there is some requirement that an affidavit of service is submitted to the court?
I think that's covered. You start there at line 19.
Okay, now I read line 19 and 20 as being evidence of the date of service, not of the fact of service or the manner of service. What I'm looking for is some place in the bill where it tells the plaintiff what the plaintiff has to do to tell the court, for the court's files, what happened to service.
May be relying upon Civil Procedure Code. It does say in the same manner as in the circuit court elsewhere, but the reason why that hasn't applied is that only applies to circuit court proceedings other than circuit court proceedings if it's so stated, and it is not there. So they may have been relying on that. If any amendment to accomplish that is there, but the first thing a judge is going to do is to look to see that there was service, and ordinarily, as you know, you have an affidavit there and you put down the return receipt. Would be on your affidavit showing it had been done. Right. Otherwise, the court wouldn't even have jurisdiction.
Right, and that's
so
why
I think it would be a natural process, but if you felt more secure in having language there, we certainly wouldn't have any.
I sure would. And the second thing, Madam Chair, if I could follow.
Yes, Representative Clark, go ahead.
Line 21, or 20 through 22, actually, if service by certified mail is not successfully accomplished, I know what successfully accomplished means in the context of certified mail, and you do too, but I can imagine situations which would raise the question of whether service had been successfully accomplished. And I wonder, should we not define that as being evidenced by a returned, signed signature card?
By the post office.
Right. That would be, in fact, the definition of successfully accomplished. Otherwise, you have the situation of saying, in other areas of the law, service is complete upon mailing. And I can imagine at least an argument being made that I made certified mailing. The statute says that's what I'm supposed to do. And that's my definition of a successfully accomplished certified mailing.
I think if you did the other that you suggested, that would obviate this, of what you're talking about now.
Yes.
because it would say you had to do that to show that you had accomplished it, and therefore I don't think you need that language here.
Okay.
I see if you, I can understand your question. If you didn't do one, why do the other? I have no, there'd be no problem with that at all as far as I'm concerned.
Madam Chair.
I'd be happy to work with you on the amendment.
Okay. Thank you.
We're going to have this for a work session later on.
Representative Minnis.
I guess I have to ask Representative Clark a question. This is current language, existing language, and apparently there's an existing practice within the court system when service is accomplished by certified mail. So I guess I would assume that there's already some standard by which they judge whether service has been accomplished or not. I don't know what that is, but I guess I'm wondering what the...
I don't know either.
Well, we'll get back to this in work session if we could. Does anyone have further questions? Excuse me, Representative Clark.
Well, I was just going to say, if Representative Minnis's point is real well taken, and I didn't notice that, but if that's the way it's currently written, then I got a problem with it.
Any other questions for Mr. Burns? Thank you, Mr. Burns. We're going to proceed into public hearing. Are there any other witnesses on House Bill 2764? We'll then proceed into public hearing on House Bill 2668. Judy Snyder, Robert Borgeford, and Christina, I know I'm just slaying a last name here.
Borgeford.
Diana
Godwin would also express an interest in coming forward in support of this bill, Madam Chair, if you would permit that.
Go ahead. Why don't you go ahead and see if you can... Counsel, do you want to find Ms. Godwin?
Yes.
She appears. We'll invite her up to counsel table with you.
Thank you. I may proceed. My name is Judy Snyder, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association in support of House Bill 2668. 2668 proposes to amend ORS 12.160. And before we discuss the amendment, I think it has to be understood that of what the existing law is. What we're dealing with in this bill is the provision of Oregon law which tolls the statute of limitations for minors who are injured as children. Right now, the statute of limitations is told for 5 years, but the claim must be brought by age 19. Under the proposed amendment, the statute of limitations would be told for 10 years. The 19-year limitation would still continue, except in cases of assault and battery to children, in which case the provisions would permit the action to be brought at any time up until the point that the victim attained the age of 21. That still is assuming it's within the 10 years plus applicable statute of limitation period or a maximum of 12 years. As I pointed out in my written testimony, this does not apply to medical negligence cases. It applies rather to the circumstances that the Borgfords are here to testify regarding. In my private practice, perhaps because I'm a woman, perhaps because this was the type of work I tended to do when I was in the district attorney's office in Multnomah County, I have found a lot of young people coming to me seeking to know what their rights and remedies are because of their physical or sexual abuse that they suffered as children. Most often, these people are coming to me when they are in their young adulthood, finally able to come to grips with the abuse that they sustained, often in their very homes. They did not pursue their claim within the existing period of limitations of the statute because they were still under the emotional, if not the economic, control and dependency of very often the individuals who abused them. Once they're out of the home, often in college or getting some semblance of identity and independence, perhaps dealing with their own sexual identity, they're finally coming to grips with the abuse that they suffered as children. They're facing a long and difficult period of psychological therapy an expensive process, obviously money well spent, necessary expenses, and frequently without the resources to pay for the psychological therapy that they so desperately need. This happened to Mr. and Mrs. Borkford's daughter, Andrea. She was a senior in high school when she was taken sexual advantage of by a high school teacher. Andrea did not come forward and did not express what had happened to her until she was 20, at which point the family came to me. This is not a bill that we've proposed solely because of something that happened to Andrea Borkford. It's a bill that has been proposed as a result of years of frustration of seeing young people finally coming to grips with what happened to them as children, facing the therapy expenses, and the frustration of not having any remedy. And I would like at this point to ask Mr. Borkford and Mrs. Borkford to spend the time telling you what their family's experience was as a result of the tragedy to their daughter.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, our daughter Andrea is a victim of sexual assault. She's a victim who, under present law, is not going to achieve even a segment of justice. And even the present House bill that we're discussing or that we're covering right now, even if that were enacted, she would not be covered under this proposed amendment. But Andrea and her mother and I hope that future victims who find themselves in the same circumstances, which are, as Ms. Snyder said, somewhat common to children of a sexual assault or abuse. We hope that that future victims will have a chance under Oregon state law to seek more justice. We also hope that this law, with the proposed changes, might be publicized and have somewhat of a deterrent effect on would-be child abusers. We've personally seen the tragedy of this happen and of a young life changed. And we're very hopeful that even though this has been devastating to Andrea and to our family, that someone in the future will have more of an ability to do something about a lawsuit or an action against the perpetrator. You have before you Andrea's statement and her mother's statement. These can just give you a hint of what the family, what Andrea especially has been through, what the family has been through, and her loved ones. It's going to be a struggle for her for years. We hope that you pass this amendment.
Thank you.
I think Mrs. Borkford wanted to make a statement.
Madam Chair, we are here because we are deeply concerned about young people. And I think that the comments which were made at the introduction of the bill speak for the uniqueness of the kind of situation that young people find themselves in with the kinds of abuse that we have come to understand are not as unusual as we had certainly considered them to have been before we have come to know a great deal of information, both through Andrea's psychologist and through the situation as it has become clear to us over the past year. And I think it's very important that the committee understand the uniqueness of the situation of sexual and abuse involved with persons of great power which exercise that power over children. And I think that where we have not been able to protect children beforehand from this kind of abuse due to the power structure that exists, and this is not only within teacher-student relationships, but I think it is clear that it happens frequently in other kinds of power relationships between the helping professions and children, that we would hope there are legal measures that can assist children once the protection has not been adequate for them to have avoided the problem that our daughter was unable to avoid. She was caught in a power situation that she was too young to deal with.
Thank you. Are there questions for the Borgfords or for Ms. Snyder? Representative
Snyder, I can't tell from looking at the bill what the menu of torts that are covered by this bill includes. Is it just abuse cases? Is it any tort? Is it any personal injury? What are we covering here?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, ORS 12.160 is somewhat the generic catch-all provision which defines and describes the tolling for people under certain disabilities, minority being one of them. There are other bills in our statute of limitations chapter which state, notwithstanding the provisions of 12.160, notwithstanding those provisions, in this particular instance, the statute of limitations shall be X. And I cited the medical and dental negligence one because that is one of those notwithstanding. My colleagues who practice in products liability tell me that that statute also has a separate and unique statute of limitations, notwithstanding 12.160, but I'm not comfortable really speaking at any length in that area. This bill would apply to your average run-of-the-mill negligence case, which I've described in my written testimony, most often would arise as a result of an automobile accident, could also conceivably arise as a result of any negligent act which led to injury, a slip and fall, for example. But the distinction that needs to be drawn, and I appreciate that this is difficult to really first run through to grasp, is what we're asking for is the tolling of the statute of limitations for 10 years for all negligence cases and assault cases. In other words, anything that does not have another bill that says notwithstanding the provisions of ORS 12.160. With the second change being for victims of assault and battery, they would be given until age 21 to file a claim instead of cutting it off at age 19. Except for assault and battery cases, all the other causes of actions would be cut off at age 19 if the statute of limitations had already expired.
Chairman?
Madam Chair?
Yes, so a follow-up, Representative Clark.
And the reason I ask the question is because I'm very sympathetic to the situation that these folks have brought forward and would be willing to consider something like that. I'm much less willing to open the door across the board in sort of generic run-of-the-mill negligence cases. They present to me two entirely different scenarios, two entirely different sets of policy analysis. I can think of no reason not to make sure the law is responsive to the situation that they've set out. I can think of some reasons not to give a blanket extension for all negligence actions. And so I guess I'm looking at this in two different ways. Well, thank you for your...
Madam Chair, may I respond to Representative Clark's concern? I know that wasn't truly a question, but I understand the concern that you're talking about. The one thing that has troubled me about the general generic negligence case, and again, we're talking about the run-of-the-mill car accident, is you're still putting the minor in a situation where they have to rely upon an adult, their parent or guardian, to initiate the claim or the action for them. Because until they're age 18, they do not have that right to independently file a claim or to proceed on their own behalf. I think we're... In the average case, we're prepared to assume that the parent is going to step forward and bring in the appropriate claim. And that's why I'd mentioned in my written testimony that it is certainly infrequent that I would expect this to arise in a routine negligence situation. It would probably be something where the parents were no doubt lacking in sophistication and were not aware of the opportunities that might be available to pursue appropriate recovery.
Which is the reason that it makes a certain amount of sense to me to accept out the abusive situation where clearly by definition the parent is not, or a lot of times the parent is not necessarily going to be the one to bring an action if it's an in-family situation.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead. Representative Mannix and then Representative Edmondson.
Yeah, it seems to me you've come in this afternoon, and with very compelling testimony, you've proven one case, but you're asserting another case. The case you've proven is that there are cases of sexual abuse where the minor, for whatever reasons, is not willing to speak up and is incapable of speaking up, or if the minor has spoken up, may have parents who are not willing to take action. And then after a period of time has passed and there's some recuperation and recovery or there's some realization of what has happened, the minor may want to assert some rights and is precluded from doing so. That's your compelling case this afternoon. But the bill that you're presenting to us is a totally different case where you're opening the door to all kinds of litigation in all kinds of areas. And I'm very sensitive to the testimony I've heard today, and I dare say a majority of this committee is sensitive to that in terms of we've done it already on the criminal side. We've extended right. The statute of limitations, the main committee, in regard to abuse cases for children. And so we may be willing to focus on one area, but I haven't heard anything from you yet that is a compelling case other than in the area of sex abuse or perhaps other forms of child abuse, physical abuse that doesn't include sexual misconduct. Do you have a compelling case that you can present to convince us that we ought to enact such a broad bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Mannix, I believe you've raised a good point with respect to the, as Representative Clark did, with respect to the broad body of law that this bill may apply to. First of all, I'd like to suggest that I don't believe you can separate physical abuse, which I think of in terms of beatings or inappropriate physical injury to a child, from sexual abuse. The dynamics are still the same. As it relates to the other forms of negligence, for example, that this bill might apply to the extent that it tolls the statute of limitations for 10 years, I submit that those circumstances are so infrequent that I'm not able at this point from my own practice, because I don't do much automobile or related negligence work, I'm not able to bring to you an example.
We'll be leaving it up to the ingenuity of our fellow attorneys to come up with examples if we open the door this broadly. That's the concern that I don't think has been addressed.
Well, except I ask you to think in terms of the injured party and ask whose rights are most important in this situation. The child who was injured at age 8 and is powerless to do anything about it, who now has only a 5-year tolling of the statute of limitations, which would leave that child 15 years of age and still being relatively incapable of acting independently to proceed to recover.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Representative Edmondson and then Representative Minnis.
Ms. Snyder, help me out here. Parental immunity in Oregon. I recall some cases, it's been several years ago, involving automobile accidents. It may have involved non-custodial parents who were drinking and had car accidents, and they had their children with them. And there was some concern about the ability to sue the parent. And in a child abuse case, I know that this isn't, I'm going beyond the situation you've obviously provided us, but we've heard in another subcommittee about the about parents who abuse their children and how those children, you know, have no one to speak for them until they become old enough. What's the status of parental immunity in this state? Can you? And I'm asking you a question that maybe come out of the left field a little bit, but I'm trying to think this through and.
Madam Chair and Representative Edmondson, the only way I can answer that is in the negative. I'm unaware of any, and this, I'm sorry, this may be due to my own lack of knowledge, but I'm unaware of any cases that deal with intentional infliction of injuries that raise the parental immunity.
But negligent infliction.
I'd have to go back. I'd be happy to research it. I think you've raised a point that I'd be happy to delve into and bring you up to date.
I wish you would, because as I recall, and you know, my practice is fairly limited, and so I don't do a lot of civil work, but as I recall, there are provisions to have guardians ad litem to prosecute civil actions on behalf of minors. Usually it's the parent, but it doesn't have to be. So I'm concerned about the young plaintiff, if you will, who can't find a guardian ad litem, and how we make sure that we don't create a situation where an adult could say, and where there are multiple plaintiffs, where the adults would be required to bring an action, but yet the minors in that situation, say a car wreck where there's a child, maybe the neighbor child is in the back seat, and the family's in the car wreck, and the family can bring an action, but the neighbor child would be waiting for 10 years for that action. I think that might create a situation that wouldn't be necessarily consistent. So to protect against that, but at the same time preserve the child's right to bring the action, I think that is what we're struggling with here now, and it might be helpful to know just what rights the child has to bring an action against parents, because those are the people who would most likely be the guardians in any action that might be brought. So, that more of a comment than a question.
A response,
I think you've got
yeah.
You've got the gist of what I'm interested in here.
Thank you, Representative Edmondson.
My only comment is I always learn something when I'm down here testifying, and I think I'm about to learn some more, because I would like to be able to look into that further, perhaps submit to counsel, Mr. Taylor, the results of my research.
Representative Minnis has a question.
Mr. and Mrs. Borgford, did you have anything to do with the design or drafting of this bill and the scope of the bill itself?
No, didn't.
No.
We had contacted Judy Snyder over a year ago as a result of our daughter's abuse coming to light. And as a result of what we have learned, we recontacted her recently and told her that we were deeply concerned about young people, and if there was ever anything that we could do to assist in the process, that we would be happy to do so. And she contacted us to tell us about this hearing.
Follow-up question?
Yes, a follow-up. Go ahead, Representative Minnis.
Since you're the principal testimony, and I don't know how many other scenarios we're going to be are going to be given to us, would you mind or would you support narrowing the bill so that it dealt with sexual molestation or physical abuse situations of minors specifically, as opposed to just a broad range of torts that could be brought?
Well, that is the main reason that we're here and one of our main concerns, but as we were listening to the interesting discussion, I certainly thought of some things myself on the personal side, where what ifs, and it seems to me that we would strongly support this part of it, but it seems to me that there would be other cases where a child had not been adequately represented for some reason, but that would seem to be just a very minor thing. It would seem that in most cases to me that if there was an automobile accident or something, that there would be immediate action. But I'm not an attorney. But we are here for children who are hurt in some way and who have no power.
I have a question for Ms. Snyder.
Go ahead.
Ms. Snyder, I'm trying to think of the justification or reason in law that there are the existing limitations, and one thing that comes to mind is the quality of the kind of evidence that could be brought into a trial, and it would appear to me, at least my common sense view is that the longer the time from the time the act occurred until the suit is commenced, that your evidence becomes somewhat skewered and less dependable. Could you comment on whether or not, if this kind of legislation passed, whether or not the quality of evidence could be maintained sufficient to prove your case in court?
Madam Chair and Representative Minnis, I would suggest that in the first instance, any attorney meeting with a client to evaluate the merits of initiating such an action would necessarily have to review the evidence, determine what witnesses, what physical evidence also might be available, and make that initial determination of whether it is feasible to maintain a lawsuit and expect to meet the burden of proof. The stakes are high in this type of litigation, and I'm not talking at all about money. I'm talking about the emotional stakes of asking the victim to be prepared to confront the abuser publicly across the table in depositions as well as in a courtroom. So while in general I think we would all agree that evidence is generally better on the immediately after the event in terms of the availability of witness and the ability to reconstruct the events, at the same time I don't see a wholesale filing of lawsuits simply because of the tolling without the careful assessment to be sure that the price to be paid by the victim is really going to be justified by the outcome of the case.
I have another question.
Representative Minnis.
Just following that up, the flip side of that would be an allegation of the sort that we've heard today would be somewhat catastrophic on the life of the individual who's the alleged abuser also. And if the evidence is borderline and the alleged violator is someone some personal wealth or substance, I mean, I guess I could see an attorney evaluating their case and making a decision, not necessarily based on the quality of the evidence, how clear-cut that is, but if they've got a reasonable case, it looks okay, but may or may not fly kind of a decision, and yet the person has some substance to their personal wealth, it's a case worth going after and then subsequently making a decision based on that. And I'm thinking of the reputation of the person who's going to be attacked in court under those circumstances. And I'm all for hanging people, I mean literally hanging people who are involved in molesting children.
Just bad people. Just bad people, though.
Well, preferably. In any event, I'm not going to get into a summary execution kind of a dissertation, but...
Thank you, Representative Minnis. Are we at the question part yet?
We're sort of there. Okay. I guess the question, if I hadn't been interrupted, I'd been there a little bit earlier. I guess the question is don't we have to take into consideration in looking at the quality of evidence the kind of charge that's going to be lodged against an individual and whether or not in the determination that that person's defense attorney or plaintiff or what is it, respondent's attorney is going to make in settling a claim, that in fact my client may have a significant amount to lose and it may be more reasonable for you to settle this thing now outside of the court. Rather than taking this thing to trial. I guess I'm looking at it from both sides. It's one thing to come in here to talk about child abuse and child molestation, so on and so forth. It's the other thing to talk about how these people are affected when they're subsequently charged. And I guess if we're looking at these kind of lawsuits that's ever going to extend it, I want to make sure that the quality of the evidence is the best you can possibly have. Anyway, there's my statement. I don't know if you respond to it or not.